Now, Asher Kaufman is a physicist like myself, and I don't know exactly when it was I first...
With hard work, he can overcome that. With
we began to write letters back and forth, Dr. Kaufman and I, long before I ever even came to Israel. Matter of fact, my introduction to Israel was by way of Egypt, which is the way the Jews came to this country at one point in their history. But in doing scientific and archaeological work on the pyramids in Egypt, I had this letter from Stanley Goldfoot in Jerusalem that urged me to come over here when it was convenient, sometime drop in, which I'm glad I did. And it was in that same time period that I became aware of Asher Kaufman's long and patient research by himself, walking around the Temple Mount, reading the literature, looking for all the tiny clues, many have since obliterated by the Muslims, that would point to the location of the temple. Asher is a dear and wonderful personal friend. I value his friendship very, very highly. His accent betrays him. You'll immediately figure out where he comes from. He's twice visited San Francisco to give lectures and technical and scientific papers. If you'd like him to come to your community, I know that he'd be happy to do so. And you could certainly have some outstanding presentations by Dr. Kaufman. But anyway, he has some slides and time for your questions. My dear friend, Asher Kaufman.
Wireless. So if you just stick that in your pocket, you can move around if you like.
Good, lovely. Good morning. Shalom to all of you.
Shalom.
Thank you for the kind words of introduction, Chuck and Lambert. I should like to read to you from Deuteronomy 12:5. It says in Hebrew there, L'shichno tidreshu uvat hashama. I shall try to translate. You shall seek his habitation and you shall come there. Notice you and you. But the Hebrew, the first you is plural. The second you is singular. Maybe I should say, you shall seek his habitation and thou shalt come there. Many people have tried to get there, to find out where the temple stood. Many, you in the plural. But it says thou, only one will get there. Only one will find the real place.
Please hold the mic closer.
Yeah, hold the mic a little closer.
I beg your pardon. I wouldn't dare to come here if I weren't sure where the actual location is. I feel I just couldn't speak to an audience with pretending to know where the actual location is. Now, you all know this place. I'm sure you've been there. Is that right?
Yes. Yes.
And the Western Wall, part of the Western Wall of the Temple area, the Temple Mount, as you prefer it. This wall is perpendicular to the Western Wall. We shall use it as a kind of landmark. And the next slide will show us a simplified map of the area. There are two colors being used, green for the area today, and red for directions, and also plans of the Second Temple. I'm just going to speak about the location and design of the Second Temple. The First Temple is a lecture by itself, maybe more than a lecture by itself. And the photographer, he stood about here and photographed this small portion of the Western Wall, and our perpendicular wall, the landmark, is here. And as you can see, it's a very simplified map. Here we have the famous Dome of the Rock. Surrounding it is the raised platform. And here is the Golden Gate. But notice where our direction north is. Quite different from what we're accustomed to. So let us do a very simple thing. Let us rotate our simplified map by 90 degrees. And I think Lambert will agree with me, or any mathematician will agree with me, this is what is called an orthogonal transformation. So let us do that. And this is what we have, and you're accustomed to having north at the top of the map, top of the slide, and that seems to satisfy us. But it doesn't satisfy Jewish people who lived here about 2,000 years ago or more, because north had no particular significance for them. The important direction was west. The east-west axis is the important axis, with west perhaps the most important direction for the temple. Why? Because the Holy of Holies was in the west, as a contradiction to the sun cult, which plagued the Jewish people so much in ancient times. So let us do one more orthogonal transformation, rotating our simplified map by 90 degrees. And here we have, we're going to forget for a few minutes about north, and we're going to concentrate upon west as our important direction. Our photographer stood about here and photographed this small portion of the western wall, which extends along here. And then, perhaps you've seen this yourself, I don't know, but about here the rock begins to appear and eventually takes over from the wall itself. As you know, most people have said that the Dome of the Rock is the site of the temple. And I think the next slide will show us what is in the Dome of the Rock. I'm sure you've seen this, but not from above. This is looking down upon the famous rock Al-Sakhra, in Arabic, the rock. And this cutting here is exactly parallel to the eastern wall of the temple area, the Temple Mount. Something quite significant, something connected with the first temple. Now, there's an interesting thing about this rock. The various Arabic historians relating to the rock, and I'll tell you very briefly about one of them. When Caliph Umar conquered Jerusalem in 638, some say 636, he consulted a converted Jew called Ka'b. And he said to Ka'b, "What shall we do? Where shall we place the mosque? Shall we place it to the south of the rock, Al-Sakhra?" And Ka'b said, "No, let us place it behind the rock." He meant to the north of the rock. And Caliph Umar said to him, "Why?" He said, "In that case, the temple of Moses," meaning the temple of Solomon, or the second temple, "the temple of Moses will be coincident with the mosque." But Caliph Umar didn't like that. He said, "We'll place it nevertheless in front, and that is to the south." So seemingly there's also evidence that the first mosque was erected somewhere to the south of the present Dome of the Rock. In my research, I've relied upon three types of evidence. It's been going on for the last 18 years. Quite a long time by now, and I should have a book in English published by now, but somehow it hasn't come forward. Instead, you've got this book here, which I'll mention in a few moments. The three types of evidence. The first type of evidence, literary sources relating to the temple. If you take the New Testament for a moment, unfortunately there's nothing there which gives us anything precise about the location of the temple. For example, I could quote to you something from John, that Jesus was strolling in the winter time in the temple area, came to the Solomon's colonnade, but that doesn't help us very much about the location of the temple. On the other hand, the Jewish ancient sources, both Josephus and the rabbinical sources, give us a lot of evidence and information about the location of the second temple. In particular, I wish to point out Tractate Midot, and my book here is a scientific edition of this Tractate Midot, which gives us a very vivid description of the second temple and also its dimensions. If I may correct Chuck for a moment, actually there's a little bit more English rather than the reference to him. At the back there are a few pages giving some information about the various drawings which are located in this book. So we have, first of all, the literary evidence, a very important item. And some people say that there are contradictions between Midot and Josephus. On the other hand, I have found that nearly everything can be explained one against the other, almost everything. The second piece of evidence And perhaps the next slide will show us a little bit of Tractate Me Dot. Ah, here we are, right. This is the beginning of Tractate Me Dot in Hebrew. Up to here is the first paragraph in the handwriting of Maimonides, the famous physician, rabbinical scholar from the Middle Ages. And subsequently, this is his commentary on the first paragraph in Arabic, but in Hebrew characters. Like people today writing Yiddish in Hebrew characters. The second piece of evidence, archaeological evidence, and perhaps we can see a little bit of this. Next slide. So let us go back to our area, and we're going to concentrate upon this part here. Please. This gives us some idea in an area photograph of what the detail is on the area. Here is the Dome of the Rock. The light part is, of course, the raised platform. Down here below is the famous Golden Gate. And let us pay attention, if I can reach it. Right at the northwest corner of the platform, the staircase, and there are various signs to the north of the staircase. Next slide, please. Concentrating upon the central portion of the simplified map, here's the Dome of the Rock, here is the raised platform, here is our staircase. There are various finds to the north of the staircase. For instance, here, there's a famous rock mass which you'll see in more detail in a few moments. Up here is a pavement which has been covered over by the Muslims over the years. And these finds here are located according to a particular direction. If you think for a moment of a famous building in ancient times as today, it would be aligned in a particular way. For the temple, you could get perhaps east-west, if not exactly approximately so. And also, the building would be built according to a certain unit of length. In the United States, you still have the feet and the yard. Here we have the meter. In ancient times, for the Jewish people, we had the cubit, in particular the medium cubit of 6 handbreadths. That's one handbreadth, 6 handbreadths, 1 cubit, from here to the tips of the finger. In fact, Vitruvius tells us how the human body is beautifully apportioned. 4 times my cubit is my height. My foot is 2/3 of a cubit. And the handbreadth, 4 fingers, 24 fingers to the medium cubit. The head is a quarter of the height, 1 cubit approximately. Anyway, that's a digression. These finds have a special alignment. They're aligned 9 degrees to the south of west. Here you have west, and here you have 9 degrees. On this side, we have other finds below ground, below the platform. This one here, called by Sir Charles Wilson, system number 5. This is the number 3, which he called. And in this little house here in the basement, there's another rock wall which is perpendicular to this particular direction. And this direction is the opposite, 9 degrees to the north of west. Here we have it here. In other words, you have what you would call in the United States a trapezoid shape, something like that. And the trapezoid is aligned exactly east-west. In the eastern wall of the platform, there are 2 rock slabs, and they're aligned exactly north-south. In other words, perpendicular to east-west. And surely this is not a coincidence. Think for a few moments, even today, cutting these cisterns exactly to that direction in the rock. They're rock cut systems. So this means something. Let us look at the rock mass in more detail. Next slide, please. Oh, sorry. This is the rock mass on two levels. Upper level, particularly flat, to within an inch or so. And lower level, I think you can see signs of masonry in the lower level. And the two levels are separated by a series of projections. On the upper level, there was seen, before it was covered over, a small piece of mosaic. And the mosaic cubes, called tesserae, the archaeologists like Latin words. The tesserae, the mosaic cubes, are ascribed to the Second Temple period, late Second Temple period by archaeologists. You can see perhaps the wall of the staircase behind the background, and seemingly this rock mass became too hot for the Muslims and they covered it over in 1978, and this is the result in the next slide. Here is the wall of the staircase, and they covered it with earth and planted a garden there. In the course of time, because of the plentiful rain, particularly last year, as you remember, rain and snow, some of it has actually been exposed. The next slide will show us another slide, another find. This is remains of a wall, ashlar stones skirting on both sides. And the young lady gives us some idea of the height of the breadth of the wall. 1.78 meters, about 6 feet. This gives you some idea of the archaeological evidence above ground and below ground, something like 50 different finds which have some significance in the area. And quite a number of them have been covered over today, over the last few years. The third piece of evidence is what I would call artistic representations of the temple. And there are very few. And the next slide shows us one of them. It's a piece of gold glass which was discovered in Rome about a century ago and is lodged today in the Vatican Museum. I saw it personally myself in 1986. And everybody agrees that this is the central feature of the temple, the house of the Lord. Ascending from an open court by these steps, four steps, but in the second temple there were 12 steps, four groups of three steps. What does one mean by gold glass? You took a piece of glass, say a beaker or something, and decorated it in this way with gold, and in order to protect it, another layer of glass was covered over, a kind of sandwich of glass. We don't know what is the origin of this, whether it was a piece of beaker, a plate. Up here it is broken, and in two dimensions the artist tried to describe something in three dimensions. Here are the colonies surrounding the court. Notice one thing which is of great interest. Here you have a straight line, and then the straight line bends inwards. And this is not an optical illusion. I have measured many times the bend, the angle of the bend, and it is 9.5 degrees plus or minus 1 degree. Is there any connection between the 9.5 and the 9? I leave it to you. This in brief is the evidence for the work which I'm now going to present to you in two stages. I can't go into the detailed calculations, are quite simple really. The mathematical calculations are really quite simple, but they depend upon the archaeological evidence on the site and also the length of the cubit, which is 43.7 centimeters for the second temple, about just over 17 inches. And we're going to assume that the archaeological evidence we have seen today has some connection with the Second Temple. Two independent methods gave the same answer as to the actual location of the axis of the Second Temple to within about 4 inches. And the uncertainty in the maps is also about the same thing, about 4 inches. One can't do better. The first thing is, what did the temple look like in two dimensions? If you remember, red is being used for temple plans as well. So the next slide, I think, will show us what the temple, the Second Temple, looked like in two dimensions. This is the latest design. It's also incorporated in the book here, and it looks very complicated indeed. I shall, in a few moments, make something simpler. We're going to leave out the various chambers on the various sides, on the south and the north, and also on the west. So in the next slide, we'll have something a little bit simpler. This is an earlier design without the detailed design of the chambers and the gates, apart from the two gates on the western side. This is the court of the women. People entered, both men and women, by the way. I think there was no segregation apart from one time during the Festival of Tabernacles. Men and women entered the court of the women, and everybody agrees this was a square. In other words, there's nothing unusual about this particular shape. One could then go into the inner court, even Israelites, up to about here, but this was essentially the court of the priests. Both courts open to the air. The inner court, the Azara, of a higher sanctity than the court of the women. But notice what its shape is. It is trapezoid shape on the western side. And this is dictated by the archaeological evidence which you saw before, the taper of 9 degrees. Within this open court, the inner court, we have the famous house, the house of the Lord, called in Hebrew Heichal. And within it, many chambers, the two most important chambers, the Holy of Holies on the western side, and to the east of it, the Holy Place. The Holy of Holies, the Holy Place, and those of you in front can perhaps see that there are two veils separated by a small space, 1 cubit. On the Day of Atonement, the high priest, Kohen Gadol, the high priest, went into the Holy of Holies 3 times, and in the dark. And the question is, was he fat or was he thin? With only a cubit to traverse, a distance of about 8 meters, 20 feet or so. This shape is also dictated by archaeology and also by what we're told in the Mishnah and also by Josephus. In the Mishnah in Midot, we're told that the house was narrow behind, broad in front, like a lion. And if you think of a lion couchant from above, you perhaps get this impression of the lion with his arms protruding outwards. Here is the altar of sacrifice, the ramp leading to the altar of sacrifice, the staircase of 12 steps leading from the inner court to the house. The actual shape is unknown. We've got no particular literary evidence, archaeological evidence as to its actual shape. It might be also somewhat a trapezoid shape according to a coin from Bar Kokhba. His real name is Bar Kokhba, from the Second Revolt, 132-135. So this gives you some idea, very briefly, of what the Second Temple looked like in plan view. The next question is, where did it stand? And perhaps we can come back to our simplified map. And we're going to concentrate upon this particular part here. Zoom on to that particular part. The Dome of the Rock is off this land. It's about here. And this is the northern part of the raised platform. Right at the very top you can see the staircase. I can't reach it. To the right is the rock mass. Various little houses here from the early Ottoman period. This is the northern edge of the platform. This is the eastern edge. Keep this in mind if there's time to show you something later. Eastern edge of the platform. System number three, system number one, which is also called this by Wilson. And we're going to try and connect the two, the temple plan in red, on this area green of today. We're going to try and do something better than H.G. Wells with the time machine. If you remember with the time machine, we could live in different times. We're going to try and live simultaneously in ancient times and in present times by superimposing the temple plan upon the existing area today. Next slide. This is the result. Is the focus all right? I can't see too well from here whether the focus is all right. Okay, good. 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 This looks rather complicated. I'll try to simplify one or two things about it. Notice that most of the area of the two courts is covered by the temple platform. What protrudes is this particular part here, and a portion here, and where the rock mass is. Part of the rock mass, the upper level, is indeed the level of the inner court, part of the inner court. And I would claim that this piece of mosaic, which I mentioned to you before, is actually part of the ancient mosaic of the inner court. We've actually got a reference, a rabbinical reference, that there was something like a mosaic pattern in the inner court. This sister number one, cut in the rock, appears rather significantly, without forcing it there, between the altar and between the porch of the house. And we've got an ancient reference which says that every 60 or 70 years, the young priest used to descend in this particular item called the sheet in order to clear it from the libation offerings. The libation offerings were poured upon the altar. Where did they go? Had to go somewhere. So they went into something called sheet, a kind of pit. And every 60, 70 years, it was cleared by these young priests. And it so happens that this system, which can collect fluids, it's plastered even today, it has rainwater in it today, just between these two items, given exactly according to the rabbinical sources. Another point, perhaps, this cistern here, we're told about the lava which was positioned about here. This could have been covered over. The lava was positioned about here to the south. At night time, it was immersed in water. And this would be a convenient system to immerse it in. Let us go on and see in this slide the two most important results of the temple research up to now. One, that on the western side the temple was taper shaped. This is the outline of the second temple, taper shaped. The second most important result is that the Dome of the Rock was not built upon the site of the temple. Even if we add the various chambers on both sides, the Dome of the Rock was still apart from the temple. In that connection, perhaps I can find a little reference. In the book of Isaiah, chapter 64, verse 10, there's a reference to, in Hebrew, Beit Mikdashenu, our temple. The famous commentator called Radak, Rabbi David Kinchi, from 1160 to 1235 approximately. And he says about this particular verse, these two words, our temple, it is still in ruins because, or rather for, it has never been built upon by the nations. A rather interesting observation, because we find that in fact, according to these results, the temple itself is free from any important buildings apart from one little item. This is actually a very important diagram for many other purposes. Let us go on and let us see what a young man called Ranyakia built for himself some 10 years ago when he was a schoolboy. Instead of opting for an examination on the subject Jerusalem, he decided to build a model of the temple. That could only work in two dimensions, he worked in three. And this is his model of the second temple, apportioned somewhat to what I've seen here. Here is the court of the women, the inner court, here is the house. It's also, he took my word for it that it should be tapered on the west. Here is the altar, the ramp. He added the various chambers on the north and on the south and the north, and he also added the Herodian extension. You can see the columns of the colonnade, and to get some idea as to the size of his model, about a meter and a half in length, he used little nails about this height to depict the columns. A very bold young man to attempt to work out for himself what would have been the height of the various walls. Not an easy thing. Josephus just tells us that the walls were higher than 40 cubits. Next slide. This is an earlier slide. Perhaps you can notice the slight differences between this one and the earlier one of the superposition. The reason why I'm showing it to you is because it has predictive qualities. A scientist should be able to say, what can it predict? And when this was worked out, I took for the dividing wall between the two courts 11 cubits, some idea why it should be so, and this would place the eastern wall of the court of the women just about here, just beyond the eastern edge of the platform. When this was worked out, there was something I didn't know, and that was, in 1970, the Muslims decided to install here a water system. Why? Because in 1969, you may remember, you might have heard, that the El Aqsa Mosque was partially destroyed by fire. And so the Israel authorities demanded from the Muslims to improve the firefighting services in the area. And here they decided to install a water reservoir. And when the area was dug here, excavated for this reservoir, Dr. Ze'ev Yebin was summoned to see something interesting. The next slide will show you, first of all, the water reservoir already installed. See, just beyond the eastern edge of the platform. Today, it is covered over by flagstones. It doesn't look circular, it looks rather squarish or rectangular. What did he see when he came to the area? Next slide. This is his own sketch from his report, which he never published, just placed it in a drawer. In 1978, somehow I got an idea that something was interesting, and I went to see him in the Rockefeller Museum, and I said, I think you've got something interesting to show me. I mentioned something, and he brought out from his drawer a two-page report, and this is on second page. This is the eastern edge of the platform. The dotted lines represent the excavation by the Muslims. The excavator, the bulldozer Xibini, came in here, and this is what he shows. Remains of an ancient wall, about 6 feet in width, and this stone in particular was rather long, about 2.5 meters long, about 8 feet long. The next slide will show you the size of these stones. This is the eastern edge of the present platform. You've seen them, I'm sure. Look at the size of these stones in relation to the eastern edge of the platform. It turns out, as you will see in the next slide, that this must have been the eastern wall of the court of the women which he saw. A comparatively small correction had to be made, because I assumed that the dividing wall between the two courts was 11 cubits. It actually turns out to be 5 cubits, like other walls. Next slide, please. This shows you here where the Yavin wall was. So the plan has predictive qualities. And if we could only dig today 1 meter by 1 meter, a small area, and I could say, dig here and we shall find a wall, and I'm sure we shall find a wall. I'm coming to the end.
Plenty of time,
okay. I've been for 45 to 50 minutes. There's something in the Holy of Holies, something green. What is it? What is it? Oh, by the way, before we change, people usually ask me, where is the wall with the young lady? Here it is. And actually, it's very important wall, because this is connected with the outer sanctified area, the entrance gate to the outer sanctified area. There was a wall there was a gate just about here. And in some photographs from the last century, when I was in the United States in November, and on the return journey also visiting Windsor just after the fire there, I saw some very important photographs which show you this particular wall from the last century quite clearly. Dan Bahad said, oh, that's from 1922. I said, you're wrong. There are photographs much earlier. And the photograph of Bedford from 1862, when the Prince of Wales came here with his visit, when he brought his own photographer called Bedford, it shows quite clearly that particular wall. So what is that little item in the Holy of Holies? Next slide. Oh, we've got it. Good. Maybe a focus, perhaps? Thank you. There's different focus because there are different sizes of different thickness of slide. Here is the Dome of the Rock. We're looking southeast approximately, and this little dome appears within the Holy of Holies. It wasn't forced there, about 4.5 meters high. I'm sure you've already seen it. Is that right?
Yes.
And so you know what I'm going to say next. Let us look at the floor of this little dome. It's not completely rock. If you looked at it very carefully, the rock protrudes on two portions. A little portion here on the southern side, and there's a much bigger portion on the northern side. But on the eastern side there's a small strip of masonry, and there are even two flagstones, and one of they're covering something on the rock, as if there's a hole in the rock. One doesn't know how deep the hole is, but it might be something connected with the pilgrim from Bordeaux who referred to the foundation stone of the temple being pierced. Anyway, you do know that this is the claim. that this is the foundation stone of the temple. And there are three names to it. Have you heard all the three names? The first name in Arabic, Kubat Arawah, the Dome of the Spirits. The second name, Kubat Al-Arwah, which means the Dome of the Tablets. And the third name, which was given to me by a local resident not far from where I live, he called it the Prison of the Genie. Spirits is perhaps a good name. Genie is not such a good name. Let us take the second name, Dome of the Tablets. It's a name given to us by one scholar, De Vogue, in 1864, in his book, in French, Le Temple de Jérusalem. And he refers to this dome. He doesn't like it. He calls it an ugly dome, not worth seeing anymore. But he says, according to the tradition he received, that it is dedicated to the tablets of the law, the tablet de la loi, the tablets of the law. And if we think for a moment that in the first temple, there was on the foundation stone the ark with the two tablets of the testimony. So somehow things fit. The third name also fits. I began to ponder why the name, the prison of the genie. And we do know that the Muslims took over quite a number of the legends and stories of Jewish sources. And in one of the references in the Talmud, the Babylonian Talmud, it is, I think, tractate Gittin, dealing with divorces, somehow or another dealing with divorces for some reason or another, we're told the story about King Solomon wanting to find the king of the genie. In order to be able to find the shamir, a particular miraculous device for cutting the stones so that in the temple nothing would be heard of the breaking and cutting of the stones, the shamir. So he had to look for the king of the genie. And when he found him, he locked him up. And the first temple and the Holy of Holies is called the Prison of the Genie. So again, the names seem to fit. I don't know how awake we are, but is there time to do a little calculation?
Sure.
Yeah. You bet.
So let us have the final slide just now. And let us do a simple calculation. If you remember, red for temple, green for today. Let us take the temple first. There was a staircase between the inner court and the house. 12 steps. According to Midot, in the book here, the step height was half a cubit. So the difference in height between the inner court and the house was 6 cubits. I apologize for working in centimeters and meters. 6 times 43.7, that's the length of the cubit. By the way, my cubit is pretty much that. We have 2.6 meters. We're told also in various rabbinical sources that the foundation stone protruded 3 finger breadths above the level in the house. And I've already told you that there are 24 finger breadths in the cubit, median cubit. So 1 cubit is more or less this finger breadth, 1.8 centimeters, just short of an inch. 3 of them is about 5 centimeters. So the difference in level between the foundation stone and the inner court is 2.7 meters. Can't do better than what we call 2 significant figures, 2.7 meters. Let's take the area today. The rock under the Dome of the Spirits is 742.7 meters above the level of the Mediterranean. And there are various features round about rock levels. In particular, let us take the rectangular system number 1, which is at a height of 740 meters. Other ones round about differ by about 10 or 20 centimeters. So once again, the difference in levels is also 2.7 meters. To my mind, this is the scientific evidence that indeed we have the foundation stone located below the little dome, the Dome of the Spirits, and not in the Dome of the Rock. And if you remember the story about Kab, he said, "Let us have the mosque behind the rock." In other words, to the north of the rock, so that the temple of Moses and the mosque may be coincident. I should like to end by referring to a kind of philosophical statement in Midot from chapter 3. I think it's particularly important for these days when in the United States and New York and here, unfortunate people's lives are being lost daily. And it says there about no iron being in contact with the altar. The altar had to be built with unhewn stones. The philosophical statement goes as follows. Iron was created to shorten man's days, and the altar was built to prolong man's days. So if the temple is rebuilt, here we have an opportunity of prolonging man's days.
I believe Dr. Kaufman will be entertaining a few questions.
May I have the first question?
Dan Baha'i spoke well of your theory, except he said your temple would fall off onto his moat, which is the flower pot. Would you answer that, please?
Is it possible to go back? First of all, I want to thank the operator for doing an excellent job. I think the easiest thing is to go back a number of slides. Backwards. Oh, good. Lovely. I thought I'd prove to Dan Baha that he's wrong. Just about here, there's a claim that there's a moat, that there was a moat there. Warren refers to it in his book of 1884. But he says he thinks that if you read that very carefully, apparently, I haven't got the statement here with me, but apparently there is a moat there. But he couldn't dig. He shows on his plans a moat about immense dimensions, about 150 feet wide and I think 20 feet deep. But he couldn't dig. He wasn't allowed to dig. So how did he know? He didn't know. He just guessed. And I think he guessed because, according to what he thought, between about here and about there, there's no evidence of rock on the surface. Actually, there's a little bit more, which I've discovered. So, Dan Baha's idea is built upon false foundations. However, there's something very interesting. There's a valley here. A natural valley here. And if you take the rock contours, we don't know them precisely, approximately. According to Warren contours, this line here falls in the middle of the valley. According to Kimo, his map, which is later based upon much more evidence, the center of the valley is to the north. But in both cases, parallel to the northern wall of the outer court. Interestingly, perhaps this wall was designed to be parallel to that particular valley, a little bit to the north.
Okay,
Lambert?
Thank you very much. Can you comment on what the rock under the dome might have been for?
One can only guess. It might have been what is called the Stone of the Claimants. In ancient times, there were no police stations, so people found something. They would go to the Temple Mount, and on some particular rock or high place, they would announce their found. They would say, "I have found it, I have found it, I have found it," three times, and wait for a claimant. And the idea was that they would wait for three festivals, a complete year, and if nobody found it, nobody claimed it, seemingly they could just keep it for themselves. So perhaps this is indeed the Stone of the Claimants. We've got circumstantial evidence that this is so because there was a very mysterious man called Onias the Circle Maker, when he wanted to do something to pray, he would make a circle and then pray within the circle. And there was a time, in contrast to last year, when we had the maximum amount of it ever recorded, there was lack of rain, and so people said to him, "Onias Choni, please pray for rain." And he drew his circle and prayed for rain. First of all, the rain came down in trickles, and they said, "This is not what we call rain." So he went back to his circle and prayed again. And this time the rain came down in torrents, perhaps like last year. And they said to him, "The lower city down here got washed out." So people left the lower city, they came to the Temple Mount. And they said, "Please pray for rain." He said, one doesn't pray for the cessation of rain. And even to the present time, this is religious law, halakha, that one doesn't pray for the cessation of rain. And he said to them, "What are you worried about? The stone of the claimants has not been covered over, hasn't been erased. So perhaps, this being the highest point," he was speaking to them in the Temple Mount and pointing out this particular rock here.
I wondered about, I've heard that there's a tunnel somewhere, the rabbi's tunnel, that the archaeologists have found.
The tunnel was dug in recent years, parallel to the Western Wall. And if you have the opportunity of going in this tunnel, the difficulty is security, because there's only one way in and the same way out. And it's just along here. And that is why I could say to you earlier that just about this point here, one begins to see the rock coming to the surface and eventually takes over the wall.
How do you reconcile the concept of a square Temple Mount with the diagram you have, the 500 meters by 500 meters?
All good questions. The 500 by 500 cubits, we're not told it is length by breadth. With regard to the Midot is a very accurate scientific document. It doesn't use words unnecessarily. With regard to the Court of the Women, which is square, it says 135 cubits length, mentions the word length, 135 cubits breadth. With regard to the outer court here, outer sanctified court, 500 cubits by 500 cubits, it doesn't say length by breadth. Now, we are used to the terminology, say, 100 square yards, or 100 yards square. The Mishnah, which is the later publication, later document than the Bible, the Old Testament, and Midot is part of the Mishnah. The language of the Mishnah doesn't know the terminology square cubit or cubit square. It defines area in the following way: a length times the same length. So 500 cubits by 500 cubits doesn't mean to say it is square. can be any shape whatsoever. And Maimonides realized this. I can prove this with many sources, many rabbinical sources, whereby it's quite clear it doesn't refer to a square. So 100 cubits by 100 cubits is a definition of square area, of area square, without defining its shape. Yes. Oh, sorry, there was somebody here first, if you don't mind.
You have a red line there with the Eastern Gate. Could you just find one on that? Is there a line out there?
Good for you. I didn't want to speak about the first temple. Now you're compelling me to do so.
Yes.
I'm supposed to speak to the Golden Age people in my own district, Beit HaKerem, next week on the first temple. They heard about this, the second temple. Now they want the next installment. So that's next week. So this is a kind of trailer to their lecture. That dotted line represents approximately, not precisely, the axis of the first temple. The imaginary line, we divided the first temple into two equal parts. This line goes through the Golden Gate. And we've now got evidence that below the Golden Gate of today, there was an ancient gate. Perhaps from Solomonic times, maybe later times. Exactly below the Golden Gate. And this line is perpendicular to the Eastern Wall. I think I'm not the only one to say, even I think Warren's people a century ago said, that this is the Holy Wall, not the Western Wall. This wall, or rather the foundations of this wall, go back to ancient times, to the time of the first temple, perhaps even to Solomon himself. Maybe the Solomon's colonnade mentioned by Jesus would be about here. So this is the line, the imaginary line, the axis of the first temple. And where does it pass? It also passes by the Dome of the Spirits. Not quite in the same place as the axis of the second temple, but very close to it. And is also within the Holy of Holies of the first temple. I think in a nutshell gives you some idea what I was referring to. In other words, the first temple was not aligned east-west exactly. It was aligned 6 degrees south of west, according to this wall here. And now, excuse me, just I'm trying to keep to order. I think there was somebody here. Yeah, that's right, yeah. Let's do each part separately, all right?
If you were given complete physical access to the Temple Mount and could commence digging, how long do you estimate it would take to identify the precise location of the temple?
I didn't hear the last bit. How long?
How long do you say it would take? Do you estimate it would take to identify the precise location that you could commence digging on the Temple Mount?
I think this would depend upon the people concerned. I would be satisfied with 1 meter by 1 meter. The skeptic would say, you found a wall there, that's pure chance, let's try somewhere else. Okay, let's try somewhere else, another meter by 1 meter.
The second aspect would be, if you had complete access to the Temple Mount for non-invasive techniques, like radar, seismic tests, etc. How long do you estimate it would take to identify the location of the temple?
Maybe one day. The physicists, including Lambert and myself, have been thinking over the years of various evasive methods like that. And it's not quite so simple. On the area itself, I don't think it's so simple. I haven't got the time to build the electronics to have some kind of sensing device for detecting metals, for example. which could be built and put in your shoe. Maybe somebody here is willing to try it. From the air, there are possibilities with infrared, but this is quite expensive. One or two attempts have been made with, I understand, non-conclusive results.
I'm not clear on one thing, Dr. Kaufman. You said that the size of the mount is 500 by 500?
The external, the sanctified outer court was 500 cubits by 500 cubits.
And then you're saying that
in area.
Right, in area. Well, you're saying that that's reference to an area. That would be about the size of this room, maybe a little bit bigger. Because the way I understood it, you meant that's the way they described area, being 500 square cubits.
No, 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 not, no. It is 25 times 10,000 square cubits, right? 25 and four zeros. You got it? That's the area, square cubits. It's a big area.
Okay, okay, so I thought you meant that it was
a... No, no.
That's an area, so it does refer to the size.
You multiply 500 by 500.
Do you have a problem with the elevation that's sort of hinted at with the sources, like the Antonia Fortress being able to see and the Palace of Herod being able to see?
I can only refer to the first point about the Antonia Fortress, which seemingly was about here. It might have extended onto the rock here. And Josephus is quite precise, from my estimation. He said that the Roman soldier in the Antonia Fortress could see what is going on in the temple. Now, the distance from here to here is comparatively short. The distance from here to here is much longer, another 100 meters. So I doubt very much if a soldier could see into what's going on here. The lady first. If you don't mind, raise your voice. I've got a slight blockage of wax in this here this morning. Pardon?
They're opposites. Yeah. In many ways. They're opposites. That's what he started his talk with. Is that
I know. That's what I meant.
Just that they're opposites. Why do the Muslims bow to the east and the other by the west? That's what she saw.
Quite obviously.
The Muslims would want to be as near as possible to Mecca Medina on the southern side. So that's why I suppose they chose, initially, Caliph Umar chose the southern side of the rock rather than the northern side.
Oh, okay.
Let me impose one last question, if I may, and this I'm just going to impose our friendship to ask him a question that has nothing to do with the presentation, yet maybe it does. Can I open the door for any conjectures on your part as to the whereabouts or possible discovery of the Ark of the Covenant?
This is a very difficult subject.
I didn't want to give you
the reason. The reason is very simple. Midot I regard as a scientific treatise, which I can use as a physicist. Dimensions have been checked, double checked, in manuscripts and within itself. When it comes to the Ark of the Covenant, the rabbinical sources are at variance, one against the other. That's the whole trouble. One source in the Mishnah itself says it is buried below the wood chamber. Now this is well defined in the work here. The wood chamber just about here. Another source says, quite valid, it is buried below the Holy of Holies. Another source says it's in Babylon. Another source, a somewhat exterior source, says it is in somewhere in Mount Nebo. So we've got plenty to work on. And that's the whole trouble.
Thank you very much, Dr.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry there wasn't time to hear more questions, but I'm very grateful to you for being patient and listeners.
Let's take about a 10-minute break, and you can corner him up here if you'd like.
We're grateful for his taking his time to come and address our group.